Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and it's a gorgeous day. If you want to be skiing, you should be doing it right now because it's going to get very heavy, very early, heading to a high of 60 degrees, 60 degrees today, Doug, with about a 40% chance of showers, and obviously those would be rain showers.
Well, and you want to follow Larry's advice because he has firsthand knowledge about it, just how heavy that snow is getting after about 11 o'clock.
Yeah, take a early and leisurely lunch and then just go home and call it a great spring ski day. And wear your sunscreen because it's going to be partly sunny, and then the rest of the week it's going to be sunny all week long, highs in the upper 40s and 50s all week long, and the lows are going to be above freezing mostly. So be careful out there early. Anyway, let's talk about the show today. We're going to continue our conversation we began last week about the Thin Air Innovation Festival, a new festival coming to Park City, which talks about the role innovation plays on the work being done by various aspects of business and nonprofits. Last week we were talking about Skull Candy's performance studio that Emily Cook, ex-Olympian, runs. And I guess you're never an ex-Olympian, you're always an Olympian. So Emily runs that and talked to us last week about that. And the Thin Air Festival begins Wednesday night, runs Thursday and Friday, and free concert for all on Friday night. And we'll talk a little bit more with Linda Jager, one of the organizers, about that. But our first guest is going to be one of the speakers at one of the panels, Eric Snyder. Eric is fairly new to Park City, but not new to the ski business. He is the CEO of Armada Skis, which relocated from Orange County to Park City about 6 months ago, and happy to have Armada Skis part of the Park City business community, and he will be one of the speakers, and we'll talk with him first.
Yeah, and you know, Larry, this Thin Air Conference is really shaping up to be a really quite exciting event. I think it makes a lot of sense that we're holding it. You're talking about how the ski day ends at 11 o'clock. Go hear some of these keynote speakers. We have Linda Jager to thank for lining up these great speakers both last week and this week. And that theme's going to continue. Our second guest this morning is Desi Mattel-Anderson, and she is the CEO of Global Disaster Innovation. You know, we think about innovation, and personally, I don't think about innovation when it comes to disaster, but when do you need it the most? You know, you could argue it's during disasters. And her title, I love her title, Larry, is Chief Wrangler of the Field Innovation Team. She's the CEO of the company I mentioned, Global Disasters Innovation, and her firm helped out in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings. And she was the Chief Innovation Advisor to FEMA. And her team's currently in Beirut, Lebanon, but we're going to have her on the phone joining us today in studio. So it's going to be a really interesting Mound Money. You're going to want to stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment on KPCW.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Welcome back to Mountain Money, and we want to welcome into the studios Eric Snyder, the CEO of Armada Skis. Tell us why, it makes sense for a ski company to be located in a ski town, but previously you were in Southern California. What made you decide to make the move up?
Well, so Armada was originally founded in 2002, and we were took a lot of influence from the board sport world, and we are two doors down from Hurley, around the corner from Volcom, and in the hub of action sports. For us to grow and to really scale our business, it was really important to move to the mountains. And when we looked at Park City had everything we were looking for, from proximity to international airport and the ability to have an idea on a Monday and then be able to test it 5 days later on snow on a Friday. So for people who are passionate about skiing, being able to hire them and bring them into the organization, as well as the ability to innovate and come up with new products, was a big part of it.
So how large is the company? How many employees? And did you hire mostly locally, or did most people follow you up from SoCal?
So out of a global organization, we have 37 people globally. We had 22 in California, which we took 12 of the 22 from California. We're now up to 27 here in Park City.
So that's a big decision, right? I mean, it makes a lot of sense to be here. We've had Peter Metcalf, founder of Black Diamond, as a guest, and 25 years ago, they made the exact same move from Southern California to Salt Lake City, really because, like you, they wanted to be testing their gear and have employees that are just fanatics. But you lost half your employees in the move. That's a big, big deal. How did you think about the benefits versus the challenges?
You know, it was tough because everyone who we were working with is kind of like family. We've been working together for a long time, and anytime you lose someone, it's always a pain for the organization. But at the same time, anytime you bring in new people, they have new ideas and new approaches, which is really beneficial to an organization. So, yeah, I would absolutely say the move was tough on the organization from a cultural perspective. But once we got here, everyone was so excited about being in the mountains. We all work at Armada because we're passionate about skiing and we love what we do. So to be in a place where we can do that more frequently was an absolute win.
So give us an idea of your product line and your niche in the outdoor sports business.
So Armada was founded back in 2002 by five pro athletes, kind of with two skis, one which was targeted to more big mountain, one that was targeted to more park and pipe. Since then, we've evolved and we have 34 different ski models, everything from park and pipe to big mountain where we started, but also an all mountain. And it's kind of spread across six different families. That's about half of our business. The other half of our business is outerwear and apparel. We make the top level Gore Pro Shell jackets to stylish jackets you can wear every day.
And where are you making the product? Is it overseas or is it Park City made?
So all of our outerwear and apparel is made over in Asia, and all of our skis are made over in Europe. We've, alongside our move here, we've built out an R&D facility where we're going to be doing rapid prototyping. We'll be doing a lot in terms of limited release product that we build here, but its primary purpose is advanced development.
And you were brought in after the company was founded. When were you brought in, and where was the company? What stage was it at that point?
So I was brought in May of 2009. The company was still, you know, a great, had amazing product, had a great brand, but it was still very much an early stage company without processes, without kind of the infrastructure you need to be able to grow and become a global organization.
And we should mention your background, MBA from Harvard, worked at managing hedge funds prior to skiing, and also played pro soccer and did some humanitarian work in Nepal. So a varied background for sure. What did you see in Armada that attracted you to the challenge of moving from hedge funds to skis?
Yeah, I think the theme, even though I've had a crazy different background, the thing that's kind of been the thread through it all has been passion, right? So being able to climb in Nepal and work for a nonprofit, being able to play soccer and follow that. Skiing is ultimately one of my largest passions, and I love skiing. So when I had the opportunity to go and join Hans and Chris and help run the management team, it was a no-brainer for me.
So you were doing your work in the hedge fund industry before business school.
Correct.
When did you graduate B school, and what did you do right after B school?
So right after business school, I went straight to Armada as CEO. Before business school, I was helping run a hedge fund and in the finance world, and prior to that, I was in strategy consulting.
So that was a strategy consulting for which firm?
PRTM, particularly O'Raben, Todd and McGrath.
Okay. Okay. So it was a little risky, actually, for Armada Skis. The reason I ask those questions, you had not had direct operational experience prior to Armada.
No, I did. I started a business in college, and my wife and I had also opened a couple of retail stores in Boston. So I had been an operator before as well.
Okay. So, but pretty risky. You had never run a company like Armada. Oftentimes, a startup company will look for, okay, we need a professional manager. And they'll look for somebody that's done something similar. Okay, the risk is, can that person do this similar thing over here? In your case, you had done some operational roles, but had never run a ski company. And your other businesses, correct me if I'm wrong, probably were not as complex as Armada Skis is.
I think that's definitely fair. It definitely, you know, running retail stores and the business I started in college were definitely not as complex as a global organization that sells in 48 different countries.
Was the idea day one when you came in as CEO, or did you quickly get promoted to CEO?
As day one.
Which is where I want to go, because there were five founders, professional athletes, and now they've got a professional manager coming in, which can be a challenge for the founders as well. Are the founders still involved in the day-to-day, or more of an advisory type role?
So the founders are involved from the perspective of advanced development, innovation, coming up with different ideas for skis, but not in the day-to-day operation of the business.
Okay. And so that can be a challenge, taking over for founders and doing many of the things that maybe the founders were doing before you came on board. And innovation is the whole theme of the Thin Air Conference, and you were talking about how the founders are involved in the innovation and they're coming up with what's the next generation of the skis. How do you guys internally balance, you know, who's doing what, and how do you get that innovation broadly disseminated within your group?
So there are a couple questions there. So the first question, kind of, you know, how has it been kind of transitioning with the founders, athlete founders, and that transition period? The athlete founders have always been kind of the ones who test the product, prove the product, and make sure it meets their needs. Because if it meets their needs and they can take the ski off the rack over at Cole Sport, then they're going to be able to, any consumer will be able to. So that wasn't as much of a transition. It was more, you know, how do you work within an organization and professionalize it without destroying or changing the culture? That was the biggest part for me and how we thought about it. In terms of innovation within Armada, I think there are a lot of different ways of innovation. And I think a lot of people, when you talk about innovation, they always just think product innovation. But innovation truly is bringing new ideas, thoughts, or models to the table. And that can be maintaining an existing business category or business initiative, or bringing new business ideas to the table. It really typically falls in one of those two areas. Within Armada, I think the way we think about it is by hiring great people and then by empowering them to do their jobs and allowing there to be a lot of collision between the different employees. So, you know, just last week we had our final validation for 17-18 product. We had our sales team, we had our marketing team, we had our products team all working together to kind of come up with the right product mix for 17-18. It's that interplay, or randomly we have a coffee bar set up at our office where people are just talking about what they're doing that helps drive innovation. A good idea can come from anywhere, and that's one of the things we try to empower everyone at Armada to be able to contribute to that.
Does innovation extend to marketing? How do you move your skis? Are they? I mean, a lot of the mass marketers just flood the market and the big boxes with lots of skis. And at the end of the year, they generally have a lot they have to deeply discount. You're not that big of a manufacturer that you can do that. So how do you get skis into the hands of those you want to be riding on them?
Yeah, so I think that's an example of an innovation, is in a different business model. A lot of our competitors use a push strategy, as you're alluding to, which is pushing product into the supply chain by giving big discounts to big boxes and just getting a lot of product out there. We try to stimulate end consumer demand and pull product through the supply chain. Our goal, and it doesn't work perfectly, but our goal is always to be able to have our product sold out, not closed out, not be on discount. In terms of marketing, you know, you can innovate in marketing. There's no question. And you know, Andy Miller and the marketing team at Armada is doing a phenomenal job. And they're looking at, how do we stimulate demand? How do we connect with consumers? How do we build a community within the ski industry? And that's also part of the reason we moved here. It's really hard to be removed from the ski world and build community. To be much closer to the consumer was a big part of our move.
So you joined Armada Skis, if I heard you correctly, May 2009.
Correct.
Right around. That was a really tough time, right? I mean, that was a tough time to graduate B school. I mean, you started B school and things were looking bad. They went from bad to worse, and you graduated right about at the bottom, right? March 2009 is when the market bottomed out, and then the economy took another 2 or 3 years after that. There were a lot of small companies that were hurting. Mm-hmm. Skiing is as much as it is as a passion, and we think of it as a way of life. It is a discretionary activity, so I would suspect that the ski industry was hit pretty hard. What was Armada like when you joined? Was it financially pretty solid, or were they in a tough spot like a lot of small companies?
I think small companies always struggle with working capital financing and things like that, and Armada was no different. Right. And from a
in fact, there was no working capital financing
correct.
Back then, which is debt, short term debt.
Exactly. MES was at 22% and it was a tough market out there. No question in the financial world. But what I think Armada had was a couple benefits. One, it was small. Right. We play in a $12 billion industry, $2 billion hard goods, $10 billion in soft goods. So when you play in that kind of space, it's easy for you to just do things a little bit better and take market share amidst a struggling or even flat industry. So for us, it was a part of, we have an amazing, amazing staff of people who are really passionate and live and die and breathe Armada. And their passion and their intelligence have made us be able to take market share even in a bad snow year. Like this year, you know, great in Utah, great in Colorado, great in the Pacific Northwest and up in BC, but East Coast and Midwest had a really tough year. Europe had a really tough year. But when you have people who are doing things just better than the rest, maybe, or having an innovative approach to marketing or a different product structure, you have the ability to start slowly but surely take market share.
So Thursday, you'll be speaking at the Thin Air Innovation Festival at in the Olympic Room at Snow Park Lodge. And we'll bring Linda Jager in a little bit to tell you how you can take part in this, but your panel is organizational innovations in performance, and you've been talking a little bit about that. But mm-hmm. but what are the themes you plan to bring forth at your panel?
So if we look today, the largest generation in the workforce are millennials, and it's a very, very different world than it was even 10, 15 years ago in the workforce. And I think how leaders and business people and everyone has to change their business model changes all the time. So I'm joined with a group of three individuals, Shauna Tellerman, Jake Newberg, and John Foley, and we're going to be spending a lot of time on how do you create an achievement mindset, how do you set culture and purpose within an organization, and how are those the things that you need to really do to be successful within a new generation who, you know, if you look at Gen X, it was all about teamwork. And that was a big part of what they cared about. And now it's just a different mindset. And how do you kind of change your business model and push achievement, growth, mindset?
So Gen X, you said, was partly about teamwork.
Correct.
What would you say what are some trends that you're seeing with the younger folks joining the workforce today? What would you say they're passionate about?
Working for organizations that align to their interests and what's important to them. So purpose is a big part of it. We have at Armada, we have a lot of really talented millennials, and for them, it's all about the passion and being able to contribute in different areas beyond whatever their functional role is. Roles are not as linear as they used to be.
It is, however, Gen X, you said, was into teamwork. Millennials, are they more siloed? Are they more interested in going their own way?
They all want to contribute, right? So giving them the opportunity and empowering them to be able to contribute, whether that's not, it's not as important to have a teamwork structure like it was for Gen X.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, stuff like your trip to Nepal resonates with the millennials, right? I mean, it's about work, it's about succeeding. I think working for somebody like yourself that has a passion, you worked for a not-for-profit in Nepal, I see a lot of that with the millennials, right? They have causes that they care about. They have things that they'd like to see done differently in society. And it's challenging, right? Because they want to somehow work for a firm that is professionally rewarding while allowing them to make that change. Are you seeing that as well?
Absolutely. And I think a big part of it is the fact that, you know, the work world is different today. Just last night, our accounts receivable payable person was emailing a customer at 10 o'clock at night on a Sunday, right? People are always working. So at Armada, how do we change our approach to empowering employees and giving them the opportunity to go try to follow their passions, go to South America to work in a on art for 2 weeks? It's looking at, you know, not having necessarily a vacation policy, but trusting that the employees are going to do their job that needs to get done and not looking over their shoulder all the time.
So let's talk about a couple of those things. It sounds like you have a flexible vacation policy. Are there other, which I'd like to talk about that, but before we go there, are there other structural systemic things that Armada has in place that enables people to follow their passions both inside of work and outside?
I think a big part of it is flexibility. So enabling them to take personal responsibility and say, hey, you know, it's a powder day. I've got all my work done. We don't have any major meetings. I'm going to take the day off. Or when we notice it from a management level that, hey, the season's coming to an end, and just sending an email out saying, hey, the office is going to be closed on Monday, which we did last Monday.
It's picked a good day. That was, as I recall, it was nice snow.
It was. But I think a big part of it is trusting, hiring the right people and trusting them to get their job done. No one likes having people look over their shoulders. And so structurally and culturally, that's a big thing.
So you're going to be talking at the Thin Air conference. These are going to be some of the themes. And so a lot of people in the audience are going to, they're going to agree with the goal, but struggle with how to get there. What's some advice you have for them?
Yes. So I think, you know, and it's going to be not necessarily advice from me, but from John, who is a lead pilot for the Blue Angels, Jake Newberg, who's CEO of Revolution Prep, and Shauna Tellerman, who runs Motsy and was a VC. And so people with very varied experience who are going to bring great ideas to the table. So I'm sure Jake's going to talk about the idea of achievement mindset. So if you look, and this was a couple of years ago, Stanford did a study where they took two groups of identical people and they gave them a test, and these students scored, you know, 50% or 50 on both. Right. And then they told one group they did something called priming, which is in psychology, giving someone an idea beforehand. And they told this group, hey, you're a group because you guys are the smartest. You're really, really smart. You did really well. Statistically, the exact same as the other group. The other group, they said, hey, you guys, you're a group because you worked really hard together. And you guys worked really hard and we're proud of that. So you're a group. They did the test again. And the group who was really smart went from 50 to 45. The group who worked really hard, you want to guess what they scored?
They did better. I know this because I'm a parent, and it's important that you tell that you praise your kids for the hard work that they do. You were saying earlier, yeah, you have a young son.
Yeah.
There's advice that was given to me when my girls were young, and it's really important, right? We praise the effort, not necessarily the outcome.
Exactly. And the outcome for those whose effort were praised, they went from 50 to 75. And at first the study, everyone was like, oh, there must have been a mistake, but it's been repeated time and time again. I think that applies to not just students and our kids, but it also applies within the work world, right? We can't just praise, hey, great job on this. It's a, guys, the way you came together and created this new marketing plan was amazing. You all had buy-in. You all looked into it. Was there disagreement? Absolutely. But you worked through that, and the outcome is great, but it was because of the effort you put in.
So I wonder how that translates down to little kids. Everybody gets a medal for everything they do. you know, do we build up kids too early with how special they all are?
I'm going to refrain from commenting on that. I don't know that I'm qualified to have an opinion on that. But with my three, I've got two boys, 3 and 5, and you know, we try to praise the effort. And for us, it isn't about the participation medal, but it's also letting them fail. I think that's something that within organizations as well, and at Armada, I have no problem if someone fails as long as they learn from it. Someone will have an idea, we'll ask questions, we'll try to, if I disagree with them, I'm not going to usurp their decision, and I'm not going to tell them what to do. But ultimately, if they fail, let's do a postmortem and figure out, okay, what went wrong and what did we learn from?
So, you know, I'm curious. You graduated B-School about 7 years ago, coming up now. And the type of business we're talking about today is very different than the type of business that existed, you know, when I first joined the workforce. I went to business school, graduated 20 years ago, different than when I left business school as well. How do people stay up on these changing trends? And then more importantly, how do they adapt? Because changing is hard.
Changing is definitely difficult. I think part of it is by not being so set in your ways to start from a mindset perspective. The idea that a good idea can come from anywhere, that keeps you fresh and aware. And frankly, within Armada, you know, I'm removed from the latest and greatest technology. I'm removed from the ideas of what's happening in social. But I've got a team who's on that all the time and who knows what the best stuff is. So being able to recognize and having the humility to say, hey, I don't know it all. And I've got a team for that reason. We've got people with complementary skill sets who bring different things to the table. So I think that's a big part of it. And to your point, the consumer world is drastically different today than it was, you know, 10 years ago. The barriers to entry in the consumer space are gone. You can go to direct to consumer for $15 a month on Shopify. You can build a brand through social media. So you have to kind of be able to adapt and disrupt yourself to be able to move forward. And I think that's what's afforded Armada the opportunity to grow, is because we continue to try to do things that are novel and different.
I'm going to put in a plug for the innovation, the Thin Air Innovation Festival. How do you change? How do you stay on trend? You know, I'm 52 years old. It's important for me to go to things like this. So AI here, what's going on? I hear viewpoints from other leaders in the business. And I challenge myself to change through that, right? It's so easy. This is a busy week. It's easy to say, oh, I don't have time to go. You know, you live here in Park City. This is going to be a heck of a conference. You really should take the time to go. Where does the audience get information on the Thin Air? We've also got in studio with us Linda Jaeger from the Park City Chamber. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, good morning.
And I just gave Eric a layup about, you know, how to stay current. And I think I honestly believe that this innovation conference is a great opportunity for here locally. I mean, really top tier speakers like Eric, like the guest we heard from last week, like Kevin Plank, the founder of Under Armour. How can people find out about the conference and when they can attend, how much it costs?
Super easy. Just jump online, get to our website, thinairparkcity.com, and you have all the information to purchase tickets and our full schedule. But the event will kick off on Wednesday night with Kevin Plank's keynote address and continue through Friday. Our panelist, Eric's panel, will happen with three others on Thursday morning, and we're having it at three different venues. And Thievery Corporation is a free event that caps off the entire event on Friday evening here on Main Street.
This is a ticketed event, so how is advance registration?
It's going really well, actually. And, you know, our first year, this is really drawing international interest. So we've got people coming in from all over. So things
Linda,
going
I'm
going
to
well.
Put you a little bit on the spot here. Park sure. City schools are on spring break. Mm-hmm. If somebody's listening in the audience and they're like, you know, I'd like to take my high schooler to something like this. This is great stuff. Is there a student rate in, you know, what needs to happen for students to be able to go with a parent or maybe with somebody from a class?
That's a great question, and thanks for bringing that up. We actually do have a Young Innovators Pass. You can actually just jump online and let us know you're interested in that. We'll get in touch with you and let you know how to redeem that pass. But we're working closely with PC Caps as well, and those kids that are not away on spring break, definitely bringing them in, as well as students from area colleges.
You know, Park City, having my kids are almost through high school now. One's entering, one's halfway through, I guess I should say. It's a tough place to go to high school because the expectations are so high, right? We were talking earlier about praising the effort, not the outcomes. We're a very outcomes-driven town, right? We have Olympic athletes here. You know, nobody does anything halfway in this town. And it makes it tough, actually, for the kids growing up. There's a lot of pressure on these kids. But one of the nice things about growing up in this town is, unlike many places in the United States, you do have these amazing events that you get to go to. You get to meet people at Sundance. You have events like this. So I think it's important that our kids get to embrace the positive side of living in a AAA society here in Park City.
Absolutely. We are so lucky. I'm a parent as well, one in college, one in high school, and the opportunities that they've had to meet different people and learn different and experience different festivals and events. This is just an additional one to add to that. I'm hoping to get my high schooler there as well. And yeah, come on out. We definitely recognize that and have created that opportunity for kids to participate.
That's been Park KPCW's tagline for years, only in Park City.
Only in Park City can you do that.
It is an extraordinary place with extraordinary opportunities like that. And we will thank Eric Snyder for being with us with Armada Skis and welcome you to town. Great to have you as part of this community. And we'll wrap up the first half of the show, and we will move on to speak with Desi Mattel Anderson, the chief wrangler of the Field Innovation Team, who will also be speaking at one of the seminars during the Thin Air Innovation Festival. We'll be back with Desi after this.
Hello, I'm Rick Redford.
And I'm Gordo Cummins with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
All Resort Group provides our guest with curbside service. Our airport black car service begins just outside of each terminal.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
Hi, I'm Margo Van Ness from Park City and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City offers events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City this winter at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, this is Blake Christian of HCVT CPAs. We are very pleased to support KPCW and to be providing full-service tax, audit, and financial consulting services to the Park City region through our newest office in Old Town. Learn more at hcvt.com.
All right. Well, it's going to be an exciting week here in Park City. The high schoolers are on vacation, and we have the Thin Air Innovation Festival. And we continue to be able to borrow guests that are going to be some of the lead speakers at that event. In studio with us now is Desi Mattel Anderson, and she has the coolest title of all. She is the Chief Wrangler of the Field Innovation Team and the CEO of Global Disaster Innovation. She has worked as one of the Chief Innovation Advisors for FEMA. Her team is currently working in Beirut, Lebanon, and helps in disaster situations like the Boston Marathon. Desi, welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, unfortunately, many of the activities that your team works on are things that all of us are all too aware of. They're happening more frequently. And I wanted to ask you to give an example of the type of work that your firm does, and maybe we could start with the Boston Marathon bombing. How did your company help out with that terrible situation?
Yes, we're actually a fleet of volunteers that have tech-infused solutions. So in the Boston Marathon bombings, one of the things that needed to be set up very quickly was the emergency operation centers, which basically is where the hub of responders go to get their information. One of the challenges when you're in a bombing situation or any kind of crisis is getting the right information. So we had a team of Canadians, Americans, people from all over the world who were catalyzing big data, through social media to help give situational awareness to responders. And that actually helped to expedite response and recovery.
Well, now there are several layers of response. So mm-hmm. how do you, as an outside organization and a private organization, interface with emergency responders, with FEMA? I could see a lot of turf battles take place.
And the neat thing about response is everybody wants to help the survivor and they want to expedite it. Being that I no longer work at FEMA, but I did at the time, and actually at the time of the marathon bombings, I was at FEMA, but the organization and the volunteers were separate. There is a lot of different layers. So if you get back to who you're trying to help and who at the end of the day you're looking to empower, it's survivors, and if you are all on the same page to do that, you actually work really well in the field together. So you got to work with every level, and you have lots of different organizations to work with.
So your model is you have people everywhere,
yes,
who are volunteers. So you don't have a huge organization per se, but you can pull together a huge organization quickly.
Yes, we actually did pull together about in 20 minutes in one particular disaster. We pulled together about 200 people to help on a hacking and coding solution. So our organization morphs from being very small and lean. And if we need a lot of manpower, we can do it very quickly.
So you're in the business of innovation, right? Yeah. Helping people solve solutions. Nobody expected the Boston Marathon bombing to take place. It did. Now all of a sudden we need these systems, these procedures in place. You also are a consumer of innovation, because I would think with a volunteer organization, boy, it's really hard to get the number of people working on the projects that need to be done so quickly. Let's talk about your business as a consumer of innovation. What types of tools do you use to enable you to help these volunteers, these disparate volunteers, come together as a group and make a difference?
And these volunteers are very specialized. So these are people around the world who are experts in their field. And the tools we use are really varied. We've used, in the Syrian refugee crisis, we did some coding and used some artificial intelligence tools to provide psychosocial access to 1.8 million refugees. In the mudslides in Washington State, which happened in 2014, we were using drones and robotics to help with expediting recovery efforts. So the tools are very varied, but what I can say is that we use exponential technologies. We build them in our labs, and then we take them out. We deploy them in real time, and sometimes the tools get built on field and on site.
So, is most of your work done off site, virtually, or are teams parachuting into disasters?
Both. We like to be on site and parachuting into disasters, as you put it, because you get to work with survivors and co-create the solutions together. But some solutions can be done virtually. And in those cases, those are good as well, because you can do those very fast and people can work, 24 hours, 24/7, all around the world to get solutions.
So one example you gave was hacking. Someone got hacked and needed to get unhacked and protected quickly. So how does that take place?
Yeah, cybersecurity is a real thing, right? And in fact, we're going to be keynoting at a conference in Chicago all about this. But basically, our hacking solutions or our coding solutions typically are providing relief. So can I give the recent artificial intelligence example? We're working with what's called a chatbot through a group called X2AI, who are partners with the field innovation team. And one of the things that we've been providing based on our work in the refugee crisis is psychosocial access, mental health access for refugees in this crisis. So when you get on your phone, you can register and you can have a text-based chat with a robot. And if the conversation gets to a point where stronger psychosocial services are needed, it actually switches on to a real-time therapist that can be accessed around the world 24/7 and in Arabic. So this is important, and this coding is very important because it can be done virtually, but in order to really know what people want and what survivors need, you got to be on the ground.
So I'm curious. I know a little bit about these tools. I really enjoy keeping up on what's going on in technology. Bots are essentially, you send a SMS, a text message, and it hits a server somewhere, and it gives you a response to that based on your question or the artificial intelligence that's tied to it. It's really, in many ways, replacing applications. So in the case that you just described for the Syrian helping folks out, why was the bot the better solution rather than tell people, download this application, it'll give you a richer, fuller experience?
Imagine you're in an abandoned theater in Bar Elias on the border of Lebanon in Syria, and you have thousands of children, thousands of teachers and community members and Syrians who fled homes, Damascus, Aleppo, their hometowns, and are now living as refugees. They have not been able to share their story. They don't have access to healthcare, and they don't have anyone to be a sounding board to talk about the missiles that hit their town or the barrel bombs that exploded upon their neighbor's home. This is an opportunity for them to have a chat with somebody, to start that conversation. And it's all text-based, as you mentioned. And like I said, it gives them access to a world of professionals that they can then talk to and have a sounding board. Because we frankly can't, at this point, just Lebanon itself can't hit 1.8 million refugees with psychosocial So this is an opportunity.
And how do you decide on the right? You were mentioning drones, deploying drones, I think was for the mudslides.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Larry, this sounds like a little bit like we'll be in brainstorming meetings and people will say there's no such thing as a bad idea and you throw these crazy ideas. A lot of these initially, my first reaction was, holy cows. I mean, that's kind of out there. As you think about it and pause, maybe not so out there. How do you decide which of these technologies are feasible and yes, we can do it, or you know what, we're just not ready to deploy. That's just too cutting edge. We got to go with a simpler approach.
We use a design process, actually, a three-step design process in everything we do. And we look at the situation. We carve that out. We then create a reframing or a challenge statement. From that challenge statement with the incident command, then we come up with a variety of solutions. And actually, back to that drone example, we did end up flying the quad rotor with Texas partners. However, there was a myriad of other solutions that we were looking to do, and that just made sense in that particular disaster.
Now, are other response groups thinking like you? is FEMA up on all this technology? You don't want to say bad things about FEMA because you're working with them, but are you leading the charge on this?
I think our team is on the cutting edge of a lot of these exponential technologies, and I believe there's a lot of people who are coming on board. So I don't believe everybody's mission is the same as ours to do tech-infused response, but I do think that people are really starting to embrace some of the things that we're bringing to the table.
You know, thinking back to Katrina, FEMA was widely panned for being late to the game and not realizing the scale of it. Were those fair criticisms at the time, and has FEMA improved and sharpened its game?
I define it this way. I look at every disaster uniquely, and in Katrina, there was more of an us versus them. In like Hurricane Sandy and some of the more, you know, modern disasters, the ones that have happened recently, it became more of a we. So it was survivors and responders working together in the field. And I think the biggest difference is empowering survivors and not letting them be victims.
So, Desi, I think our audience is going to be surprised when I share with them your background. You're not a technology. That's not your background. You're an attorney.
That's right.
Graduated 2009, mm-hmm. I believe joined FEMA right out of law school?
No, I actually went into, but a year was spent actually in the Urban Area Security Initiative, working with them in Wisconsin.
So what Larry's talking about with Katrina happened just before you joined FEMA. FEMA was not a very popular place for people to go. How did you make the decision that that's where you wanted to spend your efforts in the early days of your career?
You got to go where it's tough, where things really need to be fixed and things are tough. So it's important to go to maybe not go to the most glamorous job opportunity. Take something that's tough, that needs help. And I don't think I was the only one who turned my attention and said, this is a good agency. It has a lot of good value that it can bring. How can we help amplify that so we're making it an empowering community thing, not just another example of Katrina.
I want to stick on this theme just a little bit longer if we can, because as I mentioned earlier, our high school kids, our Park City schools are on break. There may be some folks listening. I think this is good advice for young people. Yeah. So FEMA is a government organization. It's bureaucratic. It's slow to change. You saw that it was doing good work and could be better. How did you think about, okay, yes, it's doing good work and could be better, but how did you think about the likelihood that one person could make a difference? Clearly you did, but how did you think about that ahead of time?
I think that I go into every situation kind of like what we go into disasters right now. We look at all the pieces. We look at the situation. We analyze it, and then we make a decision on what to do. I think that if everyone took the attitude that they can make a difference, we'd make a much more fundamental exponential difference. So I guess my piece of advice, or back to your question about why did I think I could make a difference? I think I'm one person in the big sandbox, but if there's a lot of us within the network doing something, we can make a difference.
Yeah, that's I've been to any number of disasters as a news reporter, and my job isn't to help the afflicted, it's to simply report on what's going on, and maybe that helps mobilize others. But when you appear on a disaster scene, do you look at the individual you can help, or you go in with the big picture and see how this population can be helped?
It's a micro-macro kind of concept. A lot of times we do start with an individual that we're helping, and then we look at scale. So how do we scale this up? Giving an example again back to the artificial intelligence, if you can help one person get access to psychosocial services, then how do you scale that to 1.8 million in Lebanon? And how does that then scale to the over 10 million that have left Syria?
And, you know, let's talk about this. Your business is innovation, right? You are leading a team of volunteers that are experts in their field. You're being introduced to technologies that many of us haven't even heard of. The whole idea of bots, I'm guessing over half of our audience has never even heard of. Although, simplistically, just sending your text and getting a helpful response. So your business is innovation. For folks whose business is not innovation, which is going to be much of the audience at the Thin Air Summit taking place, what advice do you have for them for staying on top of innovation, for staying current, and for being open to change?
Wow, that's a loaded gun. I guess what I would tell the audience, and I would definitely tell the Thin Air Summit Festival participants, is be very open and think creatively about what you're doing and critically about how you can make it more effective. That would be my advice, is be creative, be critical of what you're doing, and make it stronger, more effective, and more efficient.
Now, talk a little bit about the panel you are appearing at. You're moderating it, Innovations in Performance Scaled to Populations. You also have Pete Foley, CEO of Field Innovation, your group. And you also have, do you have anyone else on that panel? What are you, those are the only names I see here.
Would you like me to step in and?
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what to expect from your panel.
We've got a fantastic array of participants. Pete Foley works specifically in observing nature in the billions. His job is to look
nature
at
nature in the billions.
Nature in the billions. He looks at the patterns. Jahendra from Accenture Innovation Lab, he has a whole lot of technologies from all over the world that he curates and carves out to see how they can make exponential impact. Again, 10 to the 9th, the impact of a billion. And then we've got Denise Spell, who is, she has a drone company, and she's actually going to be flying drones with me in the United Nations in June. And she's looking at how does robotics hit and impact a million. And we've got one more named Susana from Spain. She's an engineer who designed satellites in space. How do we look at the world and its impact globally from space? So our panel's all about how do we impact a million and what are we doing to make that happen?
Interesting. And Linda Jager, let's bring you back in. When would we be hearing from Desi and her panel?
Desi's panel is Thursday morning. It starts at 8:30 to 10:30. And we'll be also having three other panels running concurrently as well.
Very fine.
And Desi, do you live here in Park City, or are you visiting for this conference?
I live here. Lucky for me, I'm just outside of Park City in Heber Valley.
And why did you decide to be based here?
I'll give you the short, but it's quite a funny story. My husband's a wireless spray antenna kind of communications nerd. He convinced me to come out to Utah to spray this antenna on trees and figure out if we could commute it up 22,000 miles into space through a little backhaul satellite. And that was pretty much the beginning of the end of me living in Wisconsin and coming to Utah.
Although they have trees in Wisconsin that could be painted with antennas.
Not these mountains.
Interesting. I think I've seen your company's business before. His business is also quite fascinating, that you can actually spray a large surface, a wall, and convert it into an antenna.
Yeah. Think of the world if we didn't have all these communication towers everywhere. Be a little bit more beautiful.
It's less connected.
It's important work. It's also risky work, like yours is, right? I mean, I said, I've heard of your husband's company. I believe he was looking to raise some capital a couple years ago. These are not slam dunks, which either of you guys are doing. You know, the whole idea of taking risk and following your passions, we were talking about earlier, I was mentioning just how high pressure it is here in Park City. And sometimes the output of that can lead to taking the safe path where you know you can quote unquote succeed. Mm-hmm. How do you think about taking risk and especially with your life, with your career?
Right. I think when you follow your passion and you're strategic and you're smart and living on the edge, your life is full of so many incredible experiences. You never want to take it back. And so I say fail friendly, fail often. Keep moving fast and following your vision. And don't look back. Life's meant to take risk.
Excellent. Well, that's great advice. It's great advice for us to wrap on. Our guest this morning has been Desi Mattel Anderson, the chief wrangler in field innovation team and CEO of Global Disaster Innovations Group. Desi, clearly you're making a difference, involved in some really important projects at very important times. Thank you for making that commitment to society. We need more people in the world like you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you can hear speakers like Desi at the upcoming Thin Air Innovations Festival. Linda, I'll have you give the details of the festival that's coming up.
Thanks, Doug. We actually kick off on Wednesday night at Eccles Center with a keynote with Kevin Plank, the founder of Under Armour, and continue on Thursday with four panels that will be happening throughout town in the morning. We also have a Thin Air Innovation Lounge that is open to festival goers located at Butcher's, and we'll be hosting all sorts of different programming and kind of fireside chats with innovators at the lounge throughout festival. And then we cap it off on Friday with a street concert beginning at 6 with the innovative band Thievery Corporation.
And that is the one event that is free and open to the public.
Exactly. Thievery is free and open to the public.
And students that are interested, there's a special package for students. Go to the website.
Come to our website, thinairparkcity.com. Young Innovators Pass is open for high school and college students as well.
And the intention is you launch this year, but this becomes an annual event.
It will be an annual event this time of year, and it's just such a perfect fit for Park City, and we're so lucky to have innovators like Desi that live in our community, and Eric, and we're happy to showcase them.
Okay, well, thanks for coming in, and we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money, and interesting show this morning with some really big global thinkers.
It's really crazy to see the amazing things that people in Park City are doing.
And I love Desi's quote. I wrote it down. Go to where it's tough. go to where it's tough when you're looking for a career path, and it will challenge you and reward you.
And don't look back. That's good advice as well.
Exactly. I want to thank our great sponsors this morning for Mountain Money, Mountain West Bank, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Group, and Park City.
Excellent. Well, this was a good show, Larry. I think this is the first Monday in like 6 weeks we haven't had snow or rain outside.
And heading to a high of 60 degrees today, so it's not going to happen. Starting to cloud up, we might get some showers by afternoon, 40% chance. A little bit more chance of mixed rain and snow tonight. It will get down to 31, so it'll be colder up higher, so we could get a little dusting of snow coming up. And then it's going to be sunshine the rest of the week where your sunscreen. Exciting times, Doug, as you know, as vice chairman of the KPCW board, coming up for KPCW. On Friday, we received the license for an FM station in Salt Lake City that was given to us as a donation by Broadway Media. And we will begin operations on that station at middle of April. And that station is going to help pay the bills at this station. So it will help stabilize our revenues. And
it's important because people forget, you know, they think of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the government agencies. Those sources of funding are drying up.
It's important for our sustainability that we expand, grow. We're also going to move our signal. We'll talk about that in future weeks. Right now, it's KPCW, Park City.